and welcome back to the Dive and Dig News Podcast. My name's Lucy Blue, and this week I'm talking to Professor Dave Parham from the University of Bournemouth. Dave has been diving on an assemblage of tanks, yes, tanks, in Pool Bay known as the Valentine Tanks. So we're not talking shipwrecks this week. Here, Dave is to tell us about the damage that has been done on this scheduled historic monument. That's not good news. Let's see what Dave has to say about this. Dave, thanks very much for agreeing to talk to us on the Dive and Dig podcast, our news podcast. And we actually do have some news this week. Not to say we don't other weeks, of course, but I believe there has been some damage, quite considerable damage, that has occurred to the Valentine tanks in Studland Bay. Now, many years ago, I think I dived on these, but it was so long ago, I can't even remember. So tell us a bit about this damage and what exactly are these Valentine tanks?
Okay, Lucy, the one surviving complete tank has had the turret knocked off it about 12 months ago now. It's been struck by a large object and the turret has been completely removed from the tank and is now lying to one side of it.
Oh my God.
Exposing everything that was inside.
So there was only one entirely intact one, and this is the one that has had the damage done to it?
That's correct, yes. The other six of the seven were blown up by the Navy in the 1980s over concerns about explosives in them. And this one, for whatever reason, wasn't found at the time.
Right.
And so survived substantially intact until last October, actually, when the turret was knocked off it. So although the object is still complete, everything is there, it's now no longer an entirely intact object. Mm. It's two objects
lying
next
to
each other.
Which is a
tragedy.
Yeah. Makes you wonder why somebody would want to do that. I mean, so could you just tell me a bit about my ignorance? The Valentine tanks, I know they were for World War II, but what was their purpose? What's the history behind them?
There's two stories there, really. One is what's a Valentine tank, and then the other one is what they're doing there. And Valentine tanks were the largest type of tank the Britons ever built. It was a Second World War tank, mid-war tank, used extensively in North Africa, but also in the UK for training purposes, and also extensively by the Russians until the end of the war. The DD tanks, which is what this is an amphibious version of them.
Okay.
which were built really as part of an experiment and then for training to solve a problem, and the problem was the reinvasion of Europe by the Allied powers from the West. Because to bring the Second World War to a conclusion, the Allies had to land in Northern Europe, and to do this they had to undertake an amphibious landing that was fraught with danger. There was a long history of disastrous amphibious landings, even when the side doing the landings holds all the cards. And if you think of Gallipoli as a prime example of a disastrous landing, caused in part because although you can land on a shore, it's very difficult then to fight inland to create a bridgehead which is big enough for you to resupply the army with.
How exactly would they land, though? Sorry, that is really an ignorant question.
They were designed to be launched 5,000 yards offshore. So they were made buoyant by the addition of a canvas skirt around them. So you imagine a tent on a steel frame around the tank that extends upwards from the tank to give it buoyancy, and then a propeller attached to the stern of the tank, for want of a better word, driven by the tank's engine. And the DD, the duplex drive term for them, comes because the engine could drive both the propeller or the tank's engine, but not both at the same time.
So does that mean this 5,000 yards, I think you said, is that because that's the, like, as far as I can get before they start going under?
It was a set distance for the landings. I think it was far enough offshore. For the landing craft to be relatively safe, because they were driven off tank landing craft, with the idea then that they'd make their own way ashore, and they'd land with the initial wave of infantry, and the idea with having them swim ashore was it's relatively easy to hit one large ship full of tanks. It's a lot less easy to hit a single tank that's floating and looks like a small boat. So the purpose of them was to give armoured support to the infantry in the initial landing wave to enable them to get off the beach. Most of the German defences were on the beach, enable them to get off the beach and inshore and enlarge the beachhead. So in terms of the plan for D-Day, they were a critical part of it. And on the day they were largely successful, there was only one notable failure, which is the American landings on Omaha Beach, where most of the tanks sank offshore. And if you've seen Saving Private Ryan, the opening scenes of that are a result of no armoured support on the beach. So that didn't occur elsewhere. So to a certain degree, these things worked.
Mm. Yeah, that's really fascinating. Area of history I'm pretty ignorant of. So presumably the ones in Sutherland Bay were they were connected with the training, I presume.
Yeah, they were part of the training in the initial run-up to the Normandy landing. So these were part of Exercise Smash. Exercise Smash was in April 1944, so only 2 months before the scheduled date for the landings, which were in Studland Bay. And this was a live-firing exercise landing a brigade of infantry and a squadron of tanks, 32 tanks that were launched.
So what? Why did they end up on the seabed? Something clearly went wrong there as well.
Well, the problem was with them is although there'd been lots of launches in relatively calm water, they hadn't been operated in the open sea before then. And having a large canvas skirt with a 17-ton weight at the bottom doesn't give you a lot of freeboard. So they'd only got freeboard of about a foot, 12 inches.
Oh my God, that's hardly anything.
It's not a lot, and may have worked better if the tanks had been able to, ship rolls, which means it's stable. Well, these don't, because the centre of gravity is below the centre of buoyancy, so they remain stable in the water column. And what tends to happen is the waves crash over the top and flood it, and then they sink. So the seven that were lost, three were lost, it looks like almost straight away off the landing craft. One was lost because it went aground and floated off. The other three, we think, had got some distance before they sank. The reports give the weather as being bad, but looking at the weather records, it wasn't that bad. I think it's a combination of it wasn't as sheltered as it had been for them previously. It could be an issue about the direction that they're facing into the waves. And one or two of accounts give the fact that the canvas apron collapsed. So I think it's probably a combination of things. And they were launched in similar weather on D-Day. 86% of them made the beach. So it's a combination of stuff, really. But they didn't expect this many losses on that day. But it was 6 out of 32, so it's not catastrophic. 6 people died, it's there's still quite a lot of loss of life. But if you're invading a foreign continent and expecting to lose people in their thousands, 6 is not a huge number.
So, okay, we've got these tanks, but now you've also got the issue, which is the more pertinent, 21st century issue, which is the fact that these historic monuments, I believe they're scheduled, yes?
They're scheduled now, yes.
And what exactly does that mean? Because not all our listeners are going to know what that means.
All right. Well, there's various ways of protecting things underwater, and traditionally, the way to do it in the UK was use something called the Protections of Wrecks Act. These aren't wrecks, because a wreck's got to be a ship. These are vehicles. So the only way of protection was used in the Ancient Monuments and Areas Act, which is the terrestrial legislation, but does include vehicles. So they were scheduled, and they were one of the first few monuments to be scheduled underwater, and that act was chosen because they're vehicles and not ships.
So therefore that means that's the protection, and that's presumably fairly, I know it's a heavily dived site because it's very beautiful and it's calm and it's shallow and it's, you've got something to look at. But, presumably people know that these are protected vessels.
They know they're protected, yeah. I mean, there was a big thing in the press about it at the time, and there's a lot of local interest in them, and people come from all over the country to dive. It's particularly two that are dived the most, one of which is the one that's been damaged.
So when you said it's now not a single unit, obviously, if the turret's been removed, so they took the turret off and left it there, or...?
It looks like it's been struck by something.
Oh.
It's got a single point of impact. So I suspect it's been struck by something that's pushed it off the tank deck, and then it's lying on the seabed next to it now.
Oh. It's just curious, isn't it, that somebody would cause that sort of damage and then just, like, abandon the whole thing.
It's a bizarre thing to happen, because removing the turret exposed the insides. And we know from the 80s, when the Navy blew the others up, that inside are paper instructions, personal possessions, bits of armament, you know, all the goodies are on the inside. And from an archaeological point of view, the goodies are the interesting stuff is the goodies on the inside, because that's daft things like instructions and manuals and bits and pieces that give us an idea how these things were equipped for the training, if not equipped for the landings that occurred a few months later.
I guess it sort of begs the question, as you know, being the only really intact one, why we didn't do the damage ourselves earlier. But if they're scheduled, then you've got a sort of a dichotomy there, haven't you? But anyway, in order to extract that archaeological information,
the problem with the archaeological information inside, there's 32 live rounds inside the tank as well that are still
okay.
There and you would probably have to disturb those to remove the archaeological information. So I think it's better off staying in there. The inside of the tank's been filled with sandbags now to prevent that stuff being disturbed. So
was anything removed from the inside after the turret was removed?
Not as far as we can see. No, it looked completely undisturbed. No.
So what's happening now then? I mean, do we know, have we got any idea of who did it or what the motive was?
I think we've got a vague idea as to what happened. The police were involved, as it's a crime. Mm. The police couldn't get enough information to make a decision one way or another. We know there was a ship anchored in the area round about that time. And that's as much as we know, really, at the moment. We don't think it was the ship, though. The ship was in the area, but the damage on the tank isn't consistent with it being struck by a ship's anchor. It's like it's been struck by a single object. Mm. The other part of that story is that to protect the tanks, a mooring was put down next to them so they could be buoyed to stop people tying ropes to the tanks. And that mooring block has disappeared. So we suspect that somebody's moved the mooring block, and in doing that, they've hit the tank.
Oh, so the motive could be something completely not connected with the tank at all.
It could be, yeah. It could be. It's a bizarre thing, because there's no value in the mooring block, but it's disappeared. And in doing that, you know, well, there's two facts, I suppose. One, the tank's been struck by something heavy, and the mooring block, which is heavy, has disappeared.
So your role in all of this was trying to undertake that investigation, is that right? I mean, obviously you said it's a police inquiry, but they need an expert like yourself to be able to sort of say, well, this is what we think, you know, deconstructing the archaeological sequences.
Yeah, we've had an involvement with them for a while, really. They're local. It was an interesting project for our students to be involved in. And something I knew nothing about armoured vehicles until about 8 years ago, when we thought it'd be an interesting project, and we've learned quite a lot since. So we've got a long-term background with them. We were the people that installed the mooring block for Historic England 3 or 4 years ago. And it was us that discovered, well, we were told about the damage, and we went out and did the original inspection. Right. So we were asked to, in effect, gather evidence and also to do some mitigation work to seal the inside of the tank. Deal with the corrosion on it by attaching anodes to it. So we were the sort of people on the ground locally with a medium-term interest in them.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So Is the police inquiry still ongoing then, or
I believe it's closed now.
Oh, right. Okay.
Because although our evidence has confirmed the damage and possibly how the damage occurred, who did it at sea is a much more difficult thing to do. You know, if there wasn't a witness there at the time, or somebody involved doesn't choose to tell anybody, it's very difficult to do anything about it. Yeah. Which is the classic problem of policing these submerged sites, is unless there's somebody there when these things happen, it's difficult to you know, securely come up with a conclusion as to who the perpetrator was. Yeah. Or what the, you know, or what the cause was.
Yeah, that's a real shame, isn't it? It's such a shame to think that it was the only intact one and its damage is done. Anyway, I guess, as you say, this is the problem. Well, that's really interesting, Dave. I really appreciate you sparing the time to talk to us about this. It's a shame that maybe if you're out there, the culprit, you could step forward and make yourself known to the police before the inquiry is shut, so that we try and deter people doing this in the future. But yes, well, we'll watch the space, though. Maybe more evidence will come up and we can follow this story further. So thank you, really. Thanks, Dave. It was really good of you to spend your time.
Thanks, Lucy.
Cheers.
Thank you for your time.
That was fascinating to learn about the history of these tanks that played such a crucial role in the D-Day landings, but really sad to see them damaged. And as ever, this leads us to questions about how best to protect such sites. Anyway, thank you, the audience, for listening to the Dive and Dig News podcast. It's brought to you by the Honor Frost Foundation, a charity that supports maritime archaeology in the Eastern Mediterranean. I hope you've enjoyed this episode, and I hope you tune in again soon. Bye.